Well, I think this is an interesting time. It starts off in the 16th chapter with Paul and Silas having gone back over some of the territory they've been. And Lystra was a place, and it's an important thing happens there at Lystra, and that is that Paul chooses Timothy as a future companion. Timothy proves to be a person that Paul felt deeply about. He even referred to him on occasions as his beloved son. He was, of course, younger than Paul, and he was had perhaps been in the city of Lystra on their first visit. Whether it was that had he already been previously baptized or exactly what, but he was spoken very highly of by the Lystra congregation, and Timothy chooses to accompany Paul.
And you throughout Paul's correspondence with churches, whether it's Thessalonica or Corinth or Ephesus, you have Timothy's name coming up a great deal. In fact, the last message that Paul sent prior to his death, we think, is in 2 Timothy. And he said to Timothy, I want you to come and bring my cloak and bring Mark with you. Paul writing from a Roman prison. Whether Timothy was able to make it in time prior to Paul's execution, we don't know. But we do know that Paul's deep affection and how helpful Timothy had been to him. It does go on to say that they chose to circumcise Timothy. And why was this? Well, his father was a Greek, so he had not been circumcised. His mother, in fact, Paul later refers to his mother and his grandmother. He said, I know you first learned the faith from them, his mother Eunice and his grandmother Lois. And I think later on, Titus, who was a Gentile, Paul utterly refuses to have him circumcised. But Timothy was really Jewish background, and Paul just felt like that there's no need of. Paul was doing everything possible to not create any hindrance to the gospel. On one occasion, you remember he wrote and said, when I'm with the Jews, I'm a Jew, and when I'm with the Romans, I'm a Roman. We just think about that. I mean, I was thinking, what if I were, say, a missionary to India, and I was among a group of Hindus who do not believe in eating meat? Well, I wouldn't invite a Hindu that I was trying to convert to a good big steak. That just wouldn't be the right thing to do. With Paul, he had one main aim in mind, and he was not to be deterred from that. And so this is why that he had Timothy circumcised. They did deliver the letter from the Jerusalem church, Jerusalem council that we studied last time. They did give that to the Gentile Christians. And after going through these towns, they began to move in a westward direction. And they first thought they wanted to go into Asia, not the continent of Asia, but that was a province at that time. And it says the Holy Spirit prevented them. Now, I won't conjecture as to how that happened, whether it's a vision or what. And even they wanted to go over to Bithynia. And once again, they were deterred by the Spirit. And suddenly, Paul has a wonderful vision. There's a man from Macedonia. And he is in this vision saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. Now, what makes this terribly important is that's moving from the continent of Asia to the continent of Europe. In fact, it's moving to Greece. And when you stop and think about how that, particularly in the Middle Ages and in other times, that Europe was the center of Christianity. The Muslims took over a lot of Asia, and of course, the Far East hadn't been evangelized, but Europe becomes a great center of Christianity. It was the center of the Protestant Reformation and so forth. So this is an important step. And the first place he goes to is a place called Philippi. Now, interesting enough, many of these places were named after individuals. And one of the great heroes of Greece was Philip of Macedon. He was the father of Alexander the Great. And he was himself quite a warrior, but he didn't accomplish quite the conquest that Alexander the Great, his son, accomplished. But it was an important seaport city. As it was mentioned in the 16th chapter, in the 12th verse, it says it's a Roman colony. What that simply meant was that often that was a place where it had made a colony for Roman soldiers who had fought and then retired from the battles. And so this was a colony of Romans. And it was an important city. And Paul, there's quite a few things that happened in this city that we'll talk about tonight. He doesn't go to the synagogue, and I guess there must have been, there was a small Jewish gathering down at the seashore, and he went down there on the Sabbath, and he meets up with a woman by the name of Lydia, who was a seller of purple from Thyatira. That was a close by, but she had a home in Philippi. And I think she was I would imagine she was a woman of some wealth you don't see many merchants in that time who were female, but this woman was, and she was an important woman. And after Paul's teaching, she and her household are baptized. But she takes another step. She says, come, all of you and your companions, and I don't know, he had Timothy and Silas by this time. And at times he picked up Luke because Luke's name's not mentioned, but he suddenly changes the pronoun from they to we. And that's how we know that Luke was along on occasions. And so they do accept her invitation to stay in her home. But now there's a strange thing that's happening. It says there was a slave girl with a spirit of divination, I guess is how you pronounce it. Now, I don't know exactly what that was, but it was so supposedly contact with the supernatural world. And it was kind of some kind of spirit that was inhabiting her. But the interesting thing was that there were some people making money off of this. I don't know exactly how to compare it, but earlier in American history, there were freaks that were actually part of a carnival that people made money off of. You know, the bearded lady or the person from Borneo or a lot of strange things. Fortunately, we don't see much of that today, but that was known in the United States in, say, 50 years ago or so. So this woman had some power, but it was probably not much in her control. And she was following Paul and saying she was saying some true things. She was saying, these men are the servant of the Most High God who proclaims to you the way of salvation. But some way or another, Paul didn't think that was appropriate. In the first place, he didn't want to be connected with some kind of what we might call, psychic or some kind of spirit like that. And so he rebukes the spirit, and she's no longer has that power. But now there's a little problem because these men who were making money off of this woman are angry. If you want to make people angry, hit them in the pocketbook. And we see that in our own time. We had a lot of hard time getting the tobacco companies, for instance, to admit that they were damaging to health because that meant, well, wait a minute, I'm going to lose my income here. And So they begin to cast doubt on those who were saying, well, there's pretty good proof that lung cancer and other things are caused by smoking. Well, finally, we accepted that, but I'm just saying, and there's another instance in the book of Acts we'll run into over in Ephesus when the silversmiths get upset over the fact that they're not selling as many of the images of Diana as they had before, and they cause a big stir about it. Now, they don't say, you know, it's hurting my money supply. They have another thing that they're going to accuse Paul of. In fact, they stir up a mob and they say, Paul and Silas are brought before the masters, these masters, and they accuse them of teaching customs which are not lawful for us as Romans to receive and observe. So this is they're not, you know, the Jews were often attacking Paul and Silas and so forth, but these men were bringing them before the Romans, and the magistrates seem to have acted rather hastily, I'll put it. They accepted the words of the magistrates. They beat Paul and Silas. Actually, they beat them with rods, and then they threw them in prison and fastened them in stocks. Now, we've seen colonial times with pictures of these people whose hands are in a stock and their feet are in the stock. So they fastened them in stocks. And what they said was, they're teaching customs which are not lawful for us. Now, you know, they were throwing a lot of false charges. The magistrates acted rather hastily. Sometimes the law doesn't act according to the law. Just, you know, when a policeman, for instance, gets out of hand and destroys somebody or kills somebody without really going through the process of bringing them in and accusing them and so forth. So they're beaten with rods. They're placed in that inner prison cell. And it's very interesting. At midnight, they were praying and singing hymns. Now, and they're pretty hard to put down, these two men. And I think, and I'm going to point this out when we get to the jailer's response, I think it says that a lot of prisoners were listening to them. So some way or another, I'm sure there was some proclamation about Jesus, and the hymns that they were singing. What were the hymns of that early time? Well, largely they were the Psalms. You know, Paul writes and says Psalms and hymns and spiritual song. They didn't exactly have great songs of the church that we have today. And so they were doing that. Suddenly an earthquake occurs. The prison doors are flown open and some of the chains fall off of the prisoners. And now the jailer, what does he do? He comes in thinking, uh-oh, I've got to go ahead and commit suicide. Now remember, it was typical sometime, if you remember when Herod was angry at the fact that Peter had escaped from prison and he had the keepers of the jail executed. It was, I guess that really keeps your eye watching prisoners pretty closely. If you're suddenly going to find, well, you know, if I let these guys go, if they escape, I'm going to have to pay for it with my life. And Paul says, wait a minute. Paul calms the jailer down. He says, we're all here. And now all of a sudden, the jailer says, sirs, what must I do to be saved? Now, I've always kind of wondered how was he so quickly convinced of the nature of what these people were doing. I think he must have been listening to them or maybe had some other contact with them before they were actually placed in stocks and so forth. I don't know what the, but it seems that he had some inclination He was so relieved that his life was spared. He had been obviously highly impressed with Paul and Silas, some way or another. Perhaps the singing of the hymns, the praying. And he just, they had preached a message of salvation. And he comes in and says, what must I do to be saved? Well, Paul says, sir, it says, they replied, they, not Paul, but I guess Silas was in on the conversation too. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved. After perhaps a period of additional instruction, they then are baptized, and his household is baptized. And the jailer says, come into my house. I want to give you a wonderful meal. And he comes in, it says, rejoicing. And he presents food to Paul and Silas. Well, something happens now. Now the magistrates have kind of thought this through a little bit, and perhaps they're kind of thinking, we may have acted a little hastily here. So they tell the jailer, just let them go. There must have been some fear. Now, I started to say remorse. I don't know whether they were sorry what they did, but they begin to. I think they begin to suspect we may have acted a little too hastily here. Well, here's where Paul steps in, and it's very interesting what he does. He said, wait a minute. I'm not going to let these guys just say, sneak out of town and case closed. He said, let them come down here. And we were uncondemned Romans. Now, that's the key word. Paul is a Roman citizen, and he uses that on several occasions. Not at all hesitant to say, wait a minute, I have some rights that the average person doesn't have. I'm a Roman citizen. And we were uncondemned. You heard these people shouting and saying they've done all these sort of things. But Paul said we were uncondemned, which simply means we weren't tried. We were just beaten, and we were beaten openly. Humiliated. He said, they need to come down here. I think he also felt like that once they have a church there, they can use that information, because people knew that the magistrates had to come down and humble themselves and say, now, okay, we plead with you now, would you leave? And they go to Lydia's house, and then they do leave. But I think Paul knew his rights, and he probably thought, we're going to have a church here, and they're going to say, well, this church was founded by those scoundrels who they were beaten, and they caused a commotion and all that. And now the Christians can say, wait a minute. They were exonerated, as it were. The magistrates had to release them from prison and had to go and, in a sense, apologize. It says they did it with fear. They didn't do it because they probably were very sorry for what they'd done, but they knew that that could get them in real trouble. And they also, this is a conjecture on my part, but I think that Paul was pretty shrewd there. He just said, well, this is not the way people ought to be treated. And you've treated us, and we're Roman citizens, and we weren't formally condemned. We were beaten with rods publicly. And that's, I don't know if somebody else has another idea about that. I'll be glad to listen to you. But that would be my way of interpreting Paul's action, that he realized, wait a minute, I'm interested in advancing the cause of this infant church. And I don't want to see them being said, well, it was founded by a group of the prisoners. And so Paul said, just, let's get this a little bit straightened out here, folks. You can't just tell me to sneak out of town. I want you to come down here, and I want you to release me publicly. Well, now he goes to Thessalonica. And Thessalonica was a very important seaport. In fact, I did a little research, and I found out that it's the second most populated city in all of Greece today. Has over a million population in the metropolitan area of Thessalonica. Only Athens is a larger and more important city. Thessalonica is in the north of Greece, and Athens, as you know, is down in the southern part of Greece. So Thessalonica was an important seaport city. And so they go to Thessalonica. He reasons in the synagogue for three Sabbaths. A large number of devout Greeks and some leading women become disciples. Now, let's think about that a minute. These devout Greeks, who are they? Well, they're those that they call God-fearers. You remember there are Gentiles who become not proselytes. They don't become circumcised or keep the kosher law, but they are very impressed and won over by the monotheism of the Jews, their ethical standards. And so in some ways, they were a fertile possibility for converts because they're not as wedded to the Jewish law as Jews were, but they were believers in the God of Israel. They were believers in probably a lot of the ethical standards that you find in the Ten Commandments, for instance, and the other laws. So throughout this, it's even, they're a little more receptive than just a pagan that knows nothing about the God of Israel. They had sort of, I don't know how to say it, halfway Jews. And they were Jews in principle, but not in terms of some of the laws, the very meticulous laws of Judaism. But you know, Paul and Silas now get the regular opposition it often causes. Jews gather a mob. They were unable to find Paul and Silas, but Jason evidently had been converted and was housing them. Now, maybe somebody told Paul and Silas, there's a mob coming, get out of here. But they dragged Jason and some other disciples, and I want you to listen to what they said. They accused the Christians of turning the world upside down. These are the people, that's almost a compliment if people were to say to us, boy, those people really make a difference. They're turning the world upside down. Of course, they weren't saying that complimentary, the way they really tried to pin them, they said, they're proclaiming Jesus as a king instead of Caesar. Well, that's treason, you know. So Jesus, yes, king of your life. But not king in the sense that he's going to take over the monarchy or anything. But accusations, true of today as well as yesterday, if somebody wants to accuse you, they don't always do it with truthful statements. when people want to get you in trouble, they'll accuse you of things you didn't do. And so they said these people, they were proclaiming Jesus as a king, but they weren't. They didn't say we're trying to replace Caesar. But anyway, so Paul and Silas, they established a church here because later on Paul writes two letters, to the church at Thessalonica. And it's pretty, you know, it's obviously a well-situated church. And so they flee to Berea. And they once again preach in the Jewish synagogue in Berea. And the Bereans proved more open than those at Thessalonica. Why? They searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were true. They were. They, and the scripture, you're talking about the Old Testament. The New Testament didn't exist at this time. In fact, most scholars believe that the first letter to the first book that was written in the New Testament was the letter of Paul to Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians. Gospels hadn't been written by this. There may have been some smaller accounts of Jesus' life, but it's kind of interesting. Some of us kind of have this a hard time thinking that through, but the church was established without the New Testament. And of course, the work of the Holy Spirit is constantly mentioned. They searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so. We in the churches of Christ have often kind of had that as our motto. We're saying these things. Now, you go and look in the scriptures and see if what we're saying is true. And that's, you know, you don't say, well, that's the way we've always done it. We try to, at least what we want to do is to quote, we're known to quote the Bible. And so we're saying, and so that's the Berean some way or another. Now, that doesn't happen to be one of the letters. Paul didn't write a letter to the Bereans. At least he didn't write one we have. And but obviously they were able to make a case, and it sounded like they were able to convert people. They once again went to the Jewish synagogue. And so these people were getting out their old, the law, the scroll, and looking it over. Now, oh, you're saying Isaiah said this, that's a prophecy. Yes, that's, go look that up. They searched the scriptures daily to see if what was being taught them was so. And of course, with Paul and Silas and Timothy and all the rest of them, they were, that was in their favor. But sometime opposition, sometime the bitterness of people will cause them to go more out of their way than the truth. And the people from Thessalonica were so upset when they heard that the nearby Bereans were listening to Paul and Silas that they come and stir up trouble once again. And so Paul leaves. But he leaves Silas and Timothy in Berea to strengthen the church. And this is a kind of an interesting thing in the way that Paul was, when you really look at he was a genius in the way that he established churches and the way that he used his companions. And he would often, they would carry letters to churches for him. They would also bring correspondence from the churches to him. He would say, sound like somebody's trying to come in.
That's your microphone.
Okay. Oh. I thought it was somebody. Anyway. It's the way that Paul effectively used his companions. And he also, if someone comes in and follows him up with preaching that he considers to be true to the gospel, he compliments them. For instance, in the Corinthian letter, he says, I planted in Apollos water. So he had a great, he was not someone that... even in the Philippian letter, he said, some of them preach Christ out of envy, but I'm just glad Christ is preached. It was with him, there was one goal in mind, and he was not to be deterred, but he uses these companions very effectively. And they, you know, in the Roman letter, there were a lot of co-workers that we don't see mentioned in the book of Acts, but he mentions them in his letters. He mentions Phoebe, for instance, who most people think actually carried the book, the Roman book, to the Roman church, where Paul had never been, by the way. And most of the time that most of the letters that Paul writes, he's written to churches that he established. But there's two instances. He wrote a letter to Colossae. He indicated he was not the founder of the church in Colossae. And then in Rome, he says, I'm looking forward to it. In fact, Paul had a name that he wasn't able to fulfill. At least there's no evidence of it. He was really going to go to Rome. And then he said, I want to go on to Spain. But of course, at the end of the book of Acts, we'll find out that he was brought to Rome he was a prisoner. So he didn't carry out it, unless there's just no evidence of it in the Bible that he carried out his mission to Spain. Well, we're going along here pretty well. He's gone to Thessalonica. Gone to Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea. And now he goes to Athens. Now, Athens was a great center of Grecian culture and philosophy. Three of the greatest philosophers of all time in the 4th century BC, Socrates, who taught Plato, and Plato, who taught Aristotle. So they were Athenians. Now, of course, that was several centuries prior to this time, but there was a tradition. It was, you know, it was the center of philosophy, the center of thought. So now we find a Paul in this center, and we'll see his approach there. And it's quite different from his approach in the Jewish synagogue. It says first he was rather grieved because he saw how many idols you caught in the city. And you got an idol to nearly every god. He is fortunate. It says that he not only preached in the synagogue, but he preached daily in the marketplace. And when I was reading the book by N.T. Wright about Paul, he made a point I hadn't thought of before. He felt like that Paul's skill as a tent maker, you know, Paul would often go to a city, and rather than call on anybody to support him, he would support himself. He had been often Jewish rabbis had a manual skill, and Paul had a manual skill, and it was one that was prized a great deal, tent maker and leather goods, really. And so he was in the marketplace, and N.T. Wright says he can imagine him working there, and people would come there, and he would stop and preach the gospel. So he was working. It says in the marketplace, whether he was going from stall to stall or often was working himself, set up his own stall there as a tent maker. And that was a trade, by the way, that people really needed. So it'd be like, there's certain trades today. Normally a plumber can find work. And so Paul could find work. And of course, his demands were, his material demands, he said, in the Philippian letter, he says, I've learned in whatsoever state that I am, or be content. He was not a man that You know, he said, I've been in want and I've been in plenty. Now, Paul's plenty wasn't quite as plentiful as our plenty, I'm assured. But nevertheless, he had a wonderful attitude in that regard. Well, some of the philosophers, the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, that was Epicureans or sometimes, they almost viewed materially as eat, drink, and be merry, and for tomorrow you may die. But they were really, what they were saying is happiness is a main goal. They weren't strictly saying that they had to be physical pleasures. And the Stoics was quite a powerful philosophy. It's kind of had some touch of Buddhism in it, in that when we talk about people being Stoic today, we mean they accept this, you know, they accept, you know, difficult things, and they stoically accept it. So anyway, these philosophers said, well, we'd like to hear a little bit more about what this guy's saying. We're a little puzzled by it. So he gets an invitation to speak in the Areopagus. Now, maybe many of you have seen that site. I happen to have been in Athens. It's the Parthenon, and that area there, the Areopagus, was kind of a hill. And it says in there that the Athenians, that was one of their great habits of just talking about the meaning of life and philosophy and so forth, and listening to all kinds of things. So here Paul gets a chance to get up, and I think it's a masterful delivery. He first kind of brags on them. He says, yeah, I noticed you folks are quite religious. He didn't say, you know, he didn't immediately attack their idolatry, but he said, you're very religious. And I happen to see an altar to an unknown God. And that's the God I'm going to talk to you about. And so he then says about that. He said, now, this God doesn't dwell in temples, nor is he worshipped with images of gold and silver. Well, you know, they thought their images were pretty important. But he says, no, you've got the wrong idea. It's not a God that dwells in temples. But he said, and he doesn't. But he said, he made of one blood all nations. That's a nice thought to give him. That really declares the universality of God's love. You know, and this is quite a change for a devout Jew like Paul, who had viewed themselves as a chosen race. But now all nations have the same blood. And we know that, you know, you don't have to check a person's ethnicity. You just have to check his blood type. And so with one blood, he's made of all nations. And furthermore, he is the most powerful God, because he's the God in him we live and move and have our very being. He's the creation of mankind. Human beings are his creation. You know, they had Zeus, and they had Mercury, and they had all kinds of gods. In fact, in Athens, one of their goddesses was Athena. I guess that's where they got their name. And so, you know, they had a god of the hunt, and they had a god of the you know, Aphrodite, the god of love, and on and on. And he said, this God that I'm going to proclaim to you, he's made all nations of one blood, and he's the person who gave us life, and we live and move and have our very being. And then he went on to say, and that God commands all men everywhere to repent, because there's going to be a day of judgment for the whole world. And he is, so he's developed this sermon very beautifully, you know. And remember, he even quotes one of their poets. He doesn't quote the Old Testament. because these pagans didn't know the Old Testament, nor would it make any impression on them. And he did. He's dealing to them on a rational basis. This is it. And he was doing pretty well till he came to proclaiming that Jesus was raised from the dead. And it says at that point, some of them mocked him. However, some did believe. Now, Greeks often believed in the immortality of the soul. Plato did. Plato believed, he didn't believe in the resurrection of the body. He believed that at death, the spirit leaves. And so there's a difference in the Grecian idea of the immortality of the spirit. And so in fact, later in the Corinthian letter, I believe it was, that Paul says, you know, to the Jews, it's a stumbling block, and to the Greeks, it's foolishness. So they just said, oh, no, nobody's going to be raised from the dead, you know. And so they mocked him. However, a small number did believe. Acts mentions Dionysius, the Areopagite. I guess he's the person that kind of took care of the Areopagus, and a woman named Damaris. But I would have to say that this is one place, because Paul never writes a letter to the church at Athens. So I don't think this was wasn't as successful as some of the other places. I don't know. You know, I'm just assuming that. But I still think we could learn a lot how masterful Paul was as a preacher, because he starts off first by complimenting. I'm sure he did it in the Jewish synagogue. I commend you for your following the law and so forth. He would then veer off, but it's kind of like, you know, if you're supervising someone that you need to correct, you normally call them in and say, well, Jim, you were good. You do this real well, but so-and-so. And so Paul starts off with a compliment. You're a religious people, and you've made an altar to the unknown God. Now, this is God that you don't know about, and I'm going to tell you about this God. He's a powerful God. He's not a God that dwells in temple. He's not a God that, you know, there's no power in an image. Images are, you know, people thought they had kind of magical powers, if I can rub an image or pray to an image. And of course, one of the Ten Commandments is, you'll make no graven image of me. God is not to be, you know, not to be in some sense limited to that. So he soon departs for Athens, departs from Athens and travels to Corinth. And Corinth is a place of real success. I mean, the church there has had some problems after they got going, but Corinth is going to be, in a recent book on Paul, Themes of Paul by Richard Rohr, he says there's six important cities for Paul. And he said those cities, and he mentions them, he said the churches of Galatia, there's just a region, and Antioch, where he starts from, but he mentions Corinth, Thessalonica, Philippi, Ephesus. Those were the six that he thought were the most. They were very important cities at that time. So Paul knew that if you could get a church established in one of these important cities, they could then spread it in the region round about them. It'd be like, you know, if you decided you were going to Los Angeles, and then you could affect Pasadena and Arcadia and so forth, but you'd start in where the center was.